Full Dark, No Stars, Disc 7.
At the end of the hallway was a door marked Office Staff Only. The room beyond was large, pleasant, and filled with morning sunshine. A framed picture of Barack Obama hung on the wall, above a bumper sticker bearing the Yes, We Can slogan. Tess couldn't see her cab. The building was in the way, but she could see its shadow.
That's good. Stay right there and get your $10. And if I don't come out, don't come in. Just call the police.
Neil went to the desk in the corner and sat down.
Let's see your ID.
Tess opened her purse, fumbled past the 38, and brought out her passport and the Authors Guild card. Neil gave the passport photo only a cursory glance, but when she saw the Guild card, her eyes widened.
You're the Willow Grove lady.
Tess smiled gamely. It hurt her lips.
Guilty as charged.
Her voice sounded foggy, as though she were getting over a bad cold.
My gran loves those books.
Many grands do, Tess said. When the affection finally filters down to the next generation, the one not currently living on fixed incomes, I'm gonna buy myself a chateau in France.
Sometimes this earned her a smile. Not from Ms. Neal, however.
I hope that didn't happen here.
She wasn't more specific, and didn't have to be. Tess knew what she was talking about, and Betsy Neal knew she knew. Tess thought of revisiting the story she'd already told Patsy. The beeping smoke detector alarm, the cat under her feet, the collision with the Newell post, and didn't bother. This woman had a look of daytime efficiency about her and probably visited the Stagger Inn as infrequently as possible during its hours of operation, but she was clearly under no illusions about what sometimes happened here when the hour grew late and the guests grew drunk. She was, after all, the one who came in early on Saturday mornings to make the courtesy calls. She had probably heard her share of morning after stories featuring midnight stumbles, slips in the shower, etc., etc.
Not here,
Tess said.
Don't worry. Not even in the parking lot? If you ran into trouble there, I'll have to have Mr. Rumble talk with the security staff. Mr. Rumble's the boss, and security's supposed to check the video monitors regularly on busy nights.
It happened after I left.
I really do have to make the report anonymously now, if I mean to report it at all, because I'm lying and she'll remember. If she meant to report it at all? Of course she did. Right?
I'm very sorry.
Neil paused, seeming to debate with herself. Then she said,
I don't mean to offend you, but you probably don't have any business in a place like this to begin with. It didn't turn out so well for you. And if it got into the papers, well, my gran would be very disappointed.
Tess agreed, and because she could embellish convincingly, it was the talent that paid the bills after all, she did.
A bad boyfriend is sharper than a serpent's tooth. I think the Bible says that. Or maybe it's Dr. Phil. In any case, I've broken up with him.
A lot of women say that, then weaken. And a guy who does it once
will do it again. Yes, I know, I was very foolish. If you don't have my purse, what property of mine do you have?
Ms. Neal turned in her swivel chair. The sun licked across her face, momentarily highlighting those unusual blue eyes, opened one of her file cabinets, and brought out Tom the Tom-Tom. Tess was delighted to see her old traveling buddy. It didn't make things all better, but it was a step in the right direction.
We're not supposed to remove anything from patrons' cars, just get the address and the phone number if we can, then lock it up. But I didn't like to leave this. Thieves don't mind breaking a window to get a particularly tasty item, and it was sitting right there on your dashboard.
Thank you.
Tess felt tears springing into her eyes behind her dark glasses and willed them back.
That was very thoughtful.
Betsy Neal smiled, which transformed her stern Ms. taking care of business face to radiant in an instant.
Very welcome.
And when that boyfriend of yours comes crawling back, asking for a second chance, think of my gran and all your other loyal readers and tell him no way, Jose.
She considered.
But do it with a chain on your door, because a bad boyfriend really is sharper than a serpent's tooth.
That's good advice. Listen, I have to go. I told the cab to wait while I made sure I was really going to get my car.
And that might have been all. It really might have been. But then Neil asked, with becoming diffidence, if Tess would mind signing an autograph for her grandmother. Tess told her of course not, and in spite of all that had happened, watched with real amusement as Neil found a piece of business stationery and used a ruler to tear off the Stagger Inn logo at the top before handing it across the desk.
Make it to Mary, a true fan. Can you do that?
Tess could, and as she was adding the date, a fresh confabulation came to mind.
A man helped me when my boyfriend and I were, you know, tussling. If not for him, I might have been hurt a lot worse.
Yes, raped even.
I'd like to thank him, but I don't know his name.
I doubt if I could do you much good there. I'm just the office help.
But you're local, right?
Yes.
I met him at the little store down the road.
The Gas and Dash?
I think that's the name. It's where my boyfriend and I had our argument. It was about the car. I didn't want to drive and I wouldn't let him. We were arguing about it all the time we walked down the road. Staggered down the road. Staggered down Stag Road.
Neil smiled, as people do when they've heard a joke many times before.
Anyway, this guy came along in an old blue pickup truck with that plastic stuff for rust around the headlights. Bondo? I think that's what it's called.
Knowing damn well that was what it was called. Her father had supported the company almost single-handed.
Anyway, I remember thinking when he got out that he wasn't really riding in that truck. He was wearing it.
When she handed the signed sheet of paper back across the desk, she saw that Betsy Neal was now actually grinning.
Oh my God, I might actually know who he was. Really? Was he big or was he real big? Real big, Tess said.
She felt a peculiar watchful happiness that seemed located not in her head but in the center of her chest. It was the way she felt when the strings of some outlandish plot actually started to come together, pulling tight like the top of a nicely crafted tote bag. She always felt both surprised and not surprised when this happened. There was no satisfaction like it.
Did you happen to notice if he was wearing a ring on his little finger? Red stone? Yes, like a ruby, only too big to be real, and a brown hat.
Neil was nodding, with white splatters on it. He's been wearing the damn thing for 10 years. That's Big Driver you're talking about. I don't know where he lives, but he's local, either college or Nestor Falls. I see him around. Supermarket, hardware store, Walmart, places like that. And once you see him, you don't forget him. His real name is Al. Something Polish. You know, one of those hard-to-pronounce names. Strelkowitz, Stankowitz, something like that. I bet I could find him in the phone book, because he and his brother own a trucking company. Hawkline, I think it's called. Or maybe Eagle Line. Something with a bird in it, anyway. Want me to look him up?
No, thanks, Tess said pleasantly. You've been helpful enough, and my cab driver's waiting.
Okay. Just do yourself a favor and stay away from that boyfriend of yours. And stay away from the Stagger. Of course, if you tell anyone I said that, I'll have to find you and kill you.
Fair enough, Tess said, smiling. I deserve it.
At the doorway, she turned back.
A favor?
If I can.
If you happen to see Al, something Polish around town, don't mention that you talked to me.
She smiled more widely. It hurt her lips, but she did it.
I want to surprise him, give him a little gift or something.
Not a problem. Tess lingered a bit longer.
I love your eyes.
Neil shrugged and smiled.
Thanks. They don't quite match, do they? It used to make me self-conscious, but now... Now it works for you, Tess said. You grew into them.
I guess I did. I even picked up some work modeling in my 20s. But sometimes, you know what? It's better to grow out of things, like a taste for bad-tempered men. To that, there seemed to be nothing to say. 26. She made sure her expedition would start, then tipped the cab driver 20 instead of 10. He thanked her with feeling, then drove away toward the I-84. Tess followed, but not until she'd plugged Tom back into the cigarette lighter receptacle and powered him up.
"Hello, Tess," Tom said. "I see we're taking a trip."
"Just home, Tommy boy,"
she said, and pulled out of the parking lot, very aware she was riding on a tire that had been mounted by the man who had almost killed her. Al, something Polish. A truck-driving son of a gun.
One stop on the way.
"I don't know what you're thinking, Tess, but you should be careful."
If she had been home instead of in her car, Fritzy would have been the one to say this, and Tess would have been equally unsurprised. She had been making up voices and conversations since childhood, although at the age of 8 or 9, she'd quit doing it around other people, unless it was for comic effect.
"I don't know what I'm thinking either,"
she said, but this was not quite true. Up ahead was the US 47 intersection and the gas and dash. She signaled, turned in, and parked with the expedition's nose centered between the two payphones on the side of the building. She saw the number for Royal Limousine on the dusty cinder block between them. The numbers were crooked, straggling, written by a finger that hadn't been able to stay steady. A chill shivered its way up her back, and she wrapped her arms around herself, hugging hard. Then she got out and went to the payphone that still worked. The instruction card had been defaced, maybe by a drunk with a car key, but she could still read the salient information. No charge for 911 calls. Just lift the handset and punch in the numbers. Easy as can be. She punched 9, hesitated, punched 1, then hesitated again. She visualized a piñata and a woman poised to hit it with a stick. Soon everything inside would come tumbling out. Her friends and associates would know she had been raped. Patsy McLean would know the story about stumbling over Fritzy in the dark was a shame-driven lie, and that Tess hadn't trusted her enough to tell the truth. But really, those weren't the main things. She supposed she could stand up to a little public scrutiny, especially if it kept the man Betsy Neal had called Big Driver from raping and killing another woman. Tess realized that she might even be perceived as a heroine, a thing that had been impossible to even consider last night, when urinating hurt enough to make her cry and her mind kept returning to the image of her stolen panties in the center pocket of the Giants' bib overalls. Only, "What's in it for me?" she asked again. She spoke very quietly while looking at the telephone number she'd written in the dust. "What's in that for me?" And thought, "I have a gun, and I know how to use it." She hung up the phone and went back to her car. She looked at Tom's screen, which was showing the intersection of Stag Road and Route 47. "I need to think about this some more," she said.
"What's to think about?" Tom asked. "If you were to kill him and then get caught, you'd go to jail, raped or not."
"That's what I need to think about," she said, and turned onto US 47, which would take her to I-84. Traffic on the big highway was Saturday morning light, and being behind the wheel of her expedition was good, soothing, normal. Tom was quiet until she passed the sign reading, "Exit 9, Stoke Village, 2 miles. Then he said, "Are you sure it was an accident?"
"What?"
Tess jumped, startled. She had heard Tom's words coming out of her mouth, spoken in the deeper voice she always used for the make-believe half of her make-believe conversations. It was a voice very little like Tom the Tom-Tom's actual robo-voice, but it didn't feel like her thought.
"Are you saying the bastard raped me by accident?"
"No," Tom replied. "I'm saying if it had been up to you, you would have gone back the way you came. This way, I-84. But somebody had a better idea, didn't they? Somebody knew a shortcut."
"Yes," she agreed. "Ramona Norville did."
She considered it, then shook her head.
"That's pretty far-fetched, my friend."
To this, Tom made no reply. 27. Leaving the gas and dash, she had planned to go online and see if she could locate a trucking company, maybe a small independent that operated out of College or one of the surrounding towns. A company with a bird name, probably Hawk or Eagle. It was what the Willowgrove ladies would have done. They loved their computers and they were always texting each other like teenagers,
Other considerations aside, it would be interesting to see if her version of amateur sleuthing worked in real life. Driving up the I-84 exit ramp a mile and a half from her house, she decided that she would do a little research on Ramona Norville first. Who knew? She might discover that, besides presiding over books and brown baggers, Ramona was president of the Chicopee Rape Prevention Society. It was even plausible. Tess's hostess had pretty clearly been not just a lesbian, but a dyke lesbian. And women of that persuasion were often not fond of men who were non-rapists. Many arsonists belong to their local volunteer fire departments, Tom observed as she turned onto her street. What's that supposed to mean? Tess asked. That you shouldn't eliminate anyone based on their public affiliations. The Knitting Society ladies would never do that. But by all means, check her out online. Tom spoke in a be-my-guest tone that Tess hadn't quite expected. It was mildly irritating. How kind of you to give me permission, Thomas, she said. 28. But when she was in her office with her computer booted up, she only stared at the Apple welcome screen for the first 5 minutes, wondering if she was really thinking of finding the giant and using her gun, or if that was just the sort of fantasy to which liars for profit, such as herself, were prone. A revenge fantasy, in this case. She avoided those kinds of movies, too, but she knew they were out there. You couldn't avoid the vibe of your culture unless you were a total recluse, and Tess wasn't. In the revenge movies, admirably muscular fellows like Charles Bronson and Sylvester Stallone didn't bother with the police. They got the baddies on their own. Frontier justice. Do you feel lucky, punk? She believed that even Jodie Foster, one of Yale's more famous graduates, had made a movie of this type. Tess couldn't quite remember the title. The Courageous Woman, maybe. It was something like that anyway. Her computer flipped to the word of the day screensaver. Today's word was cormorant, which just happened to be a bird. When you send your goodies by cormorant trucking, you'll think you're flying, Tess said in her deep pretending to be Tom voice. Then she tapped a key and the screensaver disappeared. She went online, but not to one of the search engines, at least not to begin with. First she went to YouTube and typed in Richard Widmark, with no idea at all why she was doing it. No conscious one, anyway. Maybe I want to find out if the guy is really worthy of fanship, she thought. Ramona certainly thinks so. There were lots of clips. The top-rated one was a 6-minute compilation titled, He's Bad. He's Really Bad. Several hundred thousand people had viewed it. There were scenes from 3 movies, but the one that transfixed her was the first. It was black and white, it looked on the cheap side, but it was definitely one of those movies. Even the title told you so. Kiss of Death. Tess watched the entire video, then returned to the Kiss of Death segment twice. Widmark played a giggling hood, menacing an old lady in a wheelchair. He wanted information. Where's that squealing son of yours? And when the old lady wouldn't tell him, you know what I do to squealers. I let them have it in the belly so they can roll around for a long time thinking it over. He didn't shoot the old lady in the belly, though. He tied her into her wheelchair with a lamp cord and pushed her down the stairs. Tess exited YouTube, binged Richard Widmark, and found what she expected, given the power of that brief clip. Although he had played in many subsequent movies, more and more often as the hero, he was best known for Kiss of Death and the giggling, psychotic Tommy Udo. Big deal, Tess said. Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. Meaning what? Fritzy asked from the windowsill where he was sunning himself. Meaning Ramona probably fell in love with him after seeing him play a heroic sheriff or a courageous battleship commander, or something like that. She must have, Fritzy agreed, because if you're right about her sexual orientation, she probably doesn't idolize men who murder old ladies in wheelchairs. Of course, that was true. Good thinking, Fritzy. The cat regarded Tess with a skeptical eye and said, but maybe you're not right about that. Even if I'm not, Tess said. Nobody roots for psycho bad guys. She recognized this for the stupidity it was as soon as it was out of her mouth. If people didn't root for psychos, they wouldn't still be making movies about the nut in the hockey mask and the burn victim with scissors for fingers. But Fritzy did her the courtesy of not laughing. You better not, Tess said. If you're tempted, remember who fills your food dish. She Googled Ramona Norville, got 44,000 hits, added Chicopee, and got a more manageable 1,200. Although even most of those, she knew, would be coincidental dreck. The first relevant one was from the Chicopee Weekly Reminder and concerned Tess herself. Librarian Ramona Norville announces Willow Grove Friday. There I am, the starring attraction, Tess murmured. Hooray for Tessa Jean. Now let's see my supporting actress. But when she pulled up the clipping, the only photo Tess saw was her own. It was the bare shoulders publicity shot her part-time assistant routinely sent out. She wrinkled her nose and went back to Google, not sure why she wanted to look at Ramona again, only knowing that she did. When she finally found a photo of the librarian, she saw what her subconscious might already have suspected, at least judging by Tom's comments on the ride back to her house. It was in a story from the August 3rd issue of the Weekly Reminder. Brown Baggers announced speaking schedule for fall, the headline read. Below it, Ramona Norville stood on the library steps, smiling and squinting into the sun. A bad photograph, taken by a part-timer without much talent, and a bad, but probably typical, choice of clothes on Norville's part. The man-tailored blazer made her look as wide in the chest as a pro football tackle. Her shoes were ugly brown flatboats. A pair of too-tight gray slacks showcased what Tess and her friends back in middle school had called thunder thighs. Holy fucking shit, Fritzy, she said. Her voice was watery with dismay. Look at this. Fritzy didn't come over to look and didn't reply. How could he, when she was too upset to make his voice? Make sure of what you're seeing, she told herself. You had a terrible shock, Tessa Jean. Maybe the biggest shock a woman can have, short of a mortal diagnosis in a doctor's office. So make sure. She closed her eyes and summoned the image of the man from the old Ford pickup truck with the bondo around the headlights. He had seemed so friendly at first.
Didn't think you were going to meet the Jolly Green Giant out here in the Willy Wags, did ya?
Only he hadn't been green. He'd been a tanned hulk of a man who didn't ride in his pickup but wore it. Ramona Norville, not a big driver, but certainly a big librarian, was too old to be his sister. And if she was a lesbian now, she hadn't always been one, because the resemblance was unmistakable.
Unless I'm badly mistaken, I'm looking at a picture of my rapist's mother.
29. She went to the kitchen and had a drink of water, but water wasn't getting it. An old half-filled bottle of tequila had been brooding in a back corner of a kitchen cabinet for donkey's years. She took it out, considered a glass, then nipped directly from the bottle. It stung her mouth and throat, but had a positive effect otherwise. She helped herself to more, a sip rather than a nip, and then put the bottle back. She had no intention of getting drunk. If she had ever needed her wits about her, she needed them about her today. Rage, the biggest, truest rage of her adult life, had invaded her like a fever, but it wasn't like any fever she had known previously. It circulated like weird serum, cold on the right side of her body, then hot on the left, where her heart was. It seemed to come nowhere near her head, which remained clear. Clearer since she'd had the tequila, actually. She paced a series of rapid circles around the kitchen, head down, one hand massaging the ring of bruises around her throat. It did not occur to her that she was circling her kitchen as she had circled the deserted store after crawling out of the pipe Big Driver had meant for her tomb. Did she really think Ramona Norville had sent her, Tess, to her psychotic son like some kind of sacrifice? Was that likely?
It was not. could she even be sure that the two of them were mother and son based on one bad photograph and her own memory? But my memory's good, especially my memory for faces.
Well, so she thought, but probably everyone did, right?
Yes, and the whole idea's crazy. You have to admit it is.
She did admit it, but she had seen crazier things on true crime programs.
Which she did watch.
The ladies with the apartment house in San Francisco who had spent years killing their elderly tenants for their Social Security checks and burying them in the backyard. The airline pilot who murdered his wife, then froze the body so he could run her through the wood chipper behind the garage. The man who had doused his own children with gasoline and cooked them like Cornish game hens to make sure his wife never got the custody the courts had awarded her. A woman sending victims to her own son was shocking and unlikely, but not impossible. When it came to the dark fuckery of the human heart, there seemed to be no limit.
Oh, boy,
she heard herself saying in a voice that combined dismay and anger.
Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. Find out for sure if you can.
She went back to her trusty computer. Her hands were trembling badly, and it took her 3 tries to enter college trucking firms in the search field at the top of the Google page. Finally, she got it right, hit enter, and there it was, at the top of the list, Red Hawk Trucking. The entry took her to the Red Hawk website, which featured a badly animated big rig with what she assumed was a Red Hawk on the side and a bizarre smiley head man behind the wheel. The truck crossed the screen from right to left, flipped and came back left to right, then flipped again. An endless crisscross journey. The company's motto flashed red, white, and blue above the animated truck. The smiles come with the service. For those wishing to journey beyond the welcome screen, there were 4 or 5 choices, including phone numbers, rates, and testimonials from satisfied customers. Tess skipped these and clicked on the last one, which read, "Check out the newest addition to our fleet."
And when the picture came up, the final piece fell into place.
It was a much better photograph than the one of Ramona Norville standing on the library steps. In it, Tess's rapist was sitting behind the wheel of a shiny cab over Pete, with Red Hawk Trucking, College, Massachusetts, written on the door in fancy script. He wasn't wearing his bleach-splattered brown cap, and the bristly blonde crew cut revealed by its absence made him look even more like his mother, almost eerily so. His cheerful, "you can trust me" grin was the one that Tess had seen yesterday afternoon, the one he'd still been wearing when he said,
"Instead of changing your tire, how about I fuck you? How would that be?"
Looking at the photo made the weird rage serum cycle faster through her system. There was a pounding in her temples that wasn't exactly a headache. In fact, it was almost pleasant. He was wearing the red glass ring. The caption below the picture read, "Al Strelke, president of Red Hawk Trucking, seen here behind the wheel of the company's newest acquisition, a 2008 Peterbilt 389. This horse of a hauler is now available to our customers, who are the finest in all the land. Say, doesn't Al look like a proud papa?"
She heard him calling her a bitch, a whiny whore bitch, and clenched her hands into fists.
She felt her fingernails sinking into her palms and clenched them even tighter, relishing the pain.
Proud papa?
That was what her eyes kept returning to.
Proud papa.
The rage moved faster and faster, circling through her body the way she had circled her kitchen, the way she had circled the store last night, moving in and out of consciousness like an actress through a series of spotlights.
"You're gonna pay, Al. And never mind the cops, I'm the one coming to collect."
And then there was Ramona Norville, the proud papa's proud mama. Although Tess was still not sure of her, partly was not wanting to believe that a woman could allow something so horrible to happen to another woman. But she could also see an innocent explanation. Chicopee wasn't that far from college, and Ramona would have used the Stag Road shortcut all the time when she went there.
"To visit her son," Tess said, nodding.
to visit the proud papa with the new cab over Pete. For all I know, she might be the one who took the picture of him behind the wheel. And why wouldn't she recommend her favorite route to that day's speaker? But why didn't she say, I go that way all the time to visit my son? Wouldn't that be natural? Maybe she doesn't talk to strangers about the Strelky phase of her life, Tess said. The phase before she discovered short hair and comfortable shoes. It was possible, but there was the scatter of nail-studded boards to think about. The trap. Norval had sent her that way, and the trap had been set ahead of time. Because she had called him? Called him and said, I'm sending you a juicy one. Don't miss out. It still doesn't mean she was involved. Or not knowingly involved. The proud papa could keep track of her guest speakers. How hard would that be?
Not hard at all, Fritzy said after leaping up on her filing cabinet. He began to lick one of his paws.
And if he saw a photo of one he liked, a reasonably attractive one, I suppose he'd know his mother would send her back by... She stopped. No, that doesn't scan. Without some input from Ma, how would he know I wasn't driving to my home in Boston or flying back to my home in New York City?
You Googled him, Fritzy said. Maybe he Googled you, just like she did. Everything's on the internet these days, you said so yourself.
That hung together, if only by a thread. She thought there was one way to find out for sure, and that was to pay Miss Norville a surprise visit. Look in her eyes when she saw Tess. If there was nothing in them but surprise and curiosity at the return of the Willow Grove scribe, to Ramona's home rather than her library, that would be one thing. But if there was fear in them as well, the kind that might be prompted by the thought, why are you here instead of in a rusty culvert on the Stag Road?
Well,
that would be different, Fritzy, wouldn't it?
Fritzy looked at her with his cunning green eyes, still licking his paw. It looked harmless, that paw, but there were claws hidden inside it. Tess had seen them, and on occasion felt them.
She found out where I lived. Let's see if I can return the favor.
Tess went back to her computer, this time searching for a Books and Brown Baggers website. She was quite sure she'd find one. Everybody had websites these days. There were prisoners doing life for murder who had websites. And she did. The Brown Baggers posted newsy notes about their members, book reviews, and informal summaries. Not quite minutes, of their meetings. Tess chose the latter and began scrolling. It did not take her long to discover that the June 10th meeting had been held at Ramona Norville's home in Brewster. Tess had never been to this town but knew where it was, had passed a green turnpike sign pointing to it while on her way to yesterday's gig. It was only two or three exits south of Chicopee. Next, she went to the Brewster Township tax records and scrolled down until she found Ramona's name. She had paid $913.06 in property taxes the year before, said property at 75 Lacemaker Lane.
Found you, dear,
Tess murmured.
You need to think about how you're going to handle this, Fritzy said, and about how far you're willing to go.
If I'm right, Tess said, maybe quite far. She started to turn off her computer, then thought of one more thing worth checking out, although she knew it might come to nothing. She went to the Weekly Reminders homepage and clicked on Obituaries. There was a place to enter the name you were interested in, and Tess typed Strelky. There was a single hit for a man named Roscoe Strelky. According to the 1999 obit, he had died suddenly in his home at the age of 48, survived by his wife Ramona, and two sons, Alvin, 23, and Lester, 17. For a mystery writer, even of the bloodless sort known as cozies, died suddenly was a red flag. She searched the Reminders General database and found nothing more. She sat still for a moment, drumming her fingers restlessly against the arms of her chair, as she did when she was working and found herself stuck for a word, a phrase, or a way of describing something. Then she looked for a list of newspapers in Western and Southern Massachusetts and found the Springfield Republican. When she typed the name of Ramona Norville's husband, the headline that came up was stark and to the point. Chicopee businessman commits suicide. Strelke had been discovered in his garage, hanging from a rafter. There was no note and Ramona wasn't quoted, but a neighbor said that Mr. Strelke had been distraught over some trouble his older boy had been in.
What kind of trouble was Al in that got you so upset?
Tess asked the computer screen.
Was it something to do with a girl?
Assault, maybe? Sexual battery?
Was he working up to bigger things even then?
If that's why you hung yourself, you were one chicken shit daddy.
Maybe Roscoe had help, Fritzy said. From Ramona, big strong woman, you know. You ought to know, you saw her.
Again, that didn't sound like the voice she made when she was essentially talking to herself. She looked at Fritzy startled. Fritzy looked back, green eyes asking, who? Me? What Tess wanted to do was drive directly to Lacemaker Lane with her gun in her purse. What she ought to do was stop playing detective and call the police, let them handle it. It was what the old Tess would have done, but she was no longer that woman. That woman now seemed to her like a distant relative, the kind you sent a card to at Christmas and forgot for the rest of the year. Because she couldn't decide, and because she hurt all over, she went upstairs and back to bed. She slept for 4 hours and got up almost too stiff to walk. She took 2 extra strength Tylenol, waited until they improved matters, then drove down to Blockbuster Video. She carried the lemon squeezer in her purse. She thought she would always carry it now while she was riding alone. She got to Blockbuster just before closing and asked for a Jodie Foster movie called The Courageous Woman. The clerk, who had green hair, a safety pin in one ear, and looked all of 18 years old, smiled indulgently and told her the film was actually called The Brave One. Mr. Retropunk told her that for an extra 50 cents, she could get a bag of microwave popcorn to go with. Tess almost said no, then reconsidered.
Why the fuck not? She asked Mr. Retropunk. You only live once, right?
He gave her a startled, reconsidering look, then smiled and agreed that it was a case of one life to a customer. At home, she popped the corn, inserted the DVD, and plopped onto the couch with a pillow at the small of her back to cushion the scrape there. Fritzy joined her and they watched Jodie Foster go after the men, the punks, as in do you feel lucky, punk, who had killed her boyfriend. Foster got assorted other punks along the way and used a pistol to do it. The Brave One was very much that kind of a movie, but Tess enjoyed it just the same. She thought it made perfect sense. She also thought that she had been missing something all these years, the low but authentic catharsis movies like The Brave One offered. When it was over, she turned to Fritzy and said,
I wish Richard Widmark had met Jodie Foster instead of the old lady in the wheelchair. Don't you?
Fritzy agreed 1,000%. 30. Lying in bed that night with an October wind getting up to Dickens around the house and Fritzy beside her, curled up nose to tail, Tess made an agreement with herself. If she woke up tomorrow feeling as she did now, she would go to see Ramona Norville and perhaps after Ramona, depending on how things turned out on Lacemaker Lane, she would pay a visit to Alvin, big driver Strelke. More likely, she'd wake up with some semblance of sanity restored and call the police. No anonymous call either. She'd face the music and dance, proving actual rape 40 hours and God knew how many showers after the fact might be difficult, but the signs of sexual battery were written all over her body. And the women in the pipe, she was their advocate, like it or not. Tomorrow, all these revenge ideas will seem silly to me, like the kind of delusions people have when they're sick with a high fever. But when she woke up on Sunday, she was still in full new test mode. She looked at the gun on the night table and thought, I want to use it. I want to take care of this myself, and given what I've been through, I deserve to take care of it myself. But I need to make sure, and I don't want to get caught, she said to Fritzy, who was now on his feet and stretching, getting ready for another exhausting day of lying around and snacking from his bowl. Tess showered, dressed, then took a yellow legal pad out to the sun porch. She stared at her back lawn for almost 15 minutes, occasionally sipping at a cooling cup of tea. Finally, she wrote, "Don't get caught," at the top of the first sheet. She considered this soberly and then began making notes. As with each day's work when she was writing a book, she started slowly but picked up speed. 31. By 10 o'clock, she was ravenous. She cooked herself a huge brunch and ate every bite. Then she took her movie back to Blockbuster and asked if they had Kiss of Death. They didn't, but after 10 minutes of browsing, she settled on a substitute called Last House on the Left. She took it home and watched closely. In the movie, men raped a young girl and left her for dead. It was so much like what had happened to her that Tess burst into tears, crying so loudly that Fritzy ran from the room. But she stuck with it and was rewarded with a happy ending. The parents of the young girl murdered the rapists. She returned the disc to its case, which she left on the table in the hall. She would return it tomorrow, if she were still alive tomorrow. She planned to be, but nothing was certain. There were many strange twists and devious turns as one hopped down the overgrown bunny trail of life. Tess had found this out for herself. With time to kill, the daylight hours seemed to move so slowly. She went back online, searching for information about the trouble Al Strelke had been in before his father committed suicide. She found nothing. Possibly the neighbor was full of shit. Neighbors so often were. But Tess could think of another scenario. The trouble might have occurred while Strelke was still a minor. In cases like that, names weren't released to the press, and the court records, assuming the case had ever even gone to court, were sealed. But maybe he got worse, she told Fritzy.
Those guys often do get worse, Fritzy agreed.
This was rare. Tom was usually the agreeable one. Fritzy's role tended to be devil's advocate. Then a few years later, something else happened, something worse. Say Mom helped him to cover it up.
Don't forget the younger brother, Fritzy said. Lester. He might have been in on it too.
Don't confuse me with too many characters, Fritz. All I know is that Al fucking Big Driver raped me and his mother may have been an accessory. That's enough for me.
Maybe Ramona's his aunt, Fritzy speculated.
Oh, shut up, Tess said. And Fritzy did. 32. She lay down at 4 o'clock, not expecting to sleep a wink, but her healing body had its own priorities. She went under almost instantly, and when she woke to the instant dot, dot, dot of her bedside clock, she was glad she had set the alarm. Outside, a gusty October breeze was combing leaves from the trees and sending them across her backyard in colorful skitters. The light had gone that strange and depthless gold, which seems the exclusive property of late fall afternoons in New England. Her nose was better, the pain there down to a dull throb, but her throat was still sore and she hobbled rather than walked to the bathroom. She got into the shower and stayed in the stall until the bathroom was as foggy as an English moor in a Sherlock Holmes story. The shower helped. A couple of Tylenol from the medicine cabinet would help even more. She dried her hair, then swiped a clear place on the mirror. The woman in the glass looked back from the eyes haunted by rage and sanity. The glass didn't stay clear for long, but it was long enough for Tess to realize that she really meant to do this, no matter the consequences. She dressed in a black turtleneck sweater and black cargo pants with big flap pockets. She tied her hair up in a bun and then yanked on a big black gimme cap. The bun made the cap bulge a little behind, but at least no potential witness would be able to say, "I didn't get a good look at her face, but she had long blonde hair. It was tied back in one of those scrunchy things. You know, the kind you can buy at J.C. Penney,
She went down to the basement where her kayak had been stored since Labor Day and took the reel of yellow boat line from the shelf above it. She used the hedge clippers to cut off 4 feet, wound it around her forearm, then slipped the coil into one of her big pants pockets. Upstairs again in the kitchen, she tucked her Swiss Army knife into the same pocket, the left. The right pocket was for the lemon squeezer 38 and one other item, which she took from the drawer next to the stove. Then she spooned out double rations for Fritzy, but before she let him start eating, she hugged him and kissed the top of his head. The old cat flattened his ears, more in surprise than distaste, probably. She wasn't ordinarily a kissy mistress, and hurried to his dish as soon as she put him down. "Make that last," Tess told him. "Patsy will check on you eventually if I don't come back, but it could be a couple of days." She smiled a little and added, "I love you, you scruffy old thing." "Right, right," Fritzy said, then got busy eating. Tess checked her don't get caught memo one more time, mentally inventorying her supplies as she did so and going over the steps she intended to take once she got to Lacemaker Lane. She thought the most important thing to keep in mind was that things wouldn't go as she hoped they would. When it came to things like this, there were always jokers in the deck. Ramona might not be at home, or she might be at home but with her rapist murderer son, the two of them cozied up in the living room, watching something uplifting from Blockbuster. Saw, maybe. The younger brother, no doubt known in college as Little Driver, might be there as well. For all Tess knew, Ramona might be hosting a Tupperware party or a reading circle tonight. The important thing was not to get flummoxed by unexpected developments. If she couldn't improvise, Tess thought it very likely that she really was leaving her house in Stoke Village for the last time. She burned the Don't Get Caught memo in the fireplace, stirred the ashes apart with the poker, then put on her leather jacket and a pair of thin leather gloves. The jacket had a deep pocket in the lining. Tess slipped one of her butcher knives into it just for good luck, then told herself not to forget it was there. The last thing she needed this weekend was an accidental mastectomy. Just before stepping out the door, she set the burglar alarm. The wind surrounded her immediately, flapping the collar of her jacket and the legs of her cargo pants. Leaves swirled in mini cyclones. In the not quite dark sky above her tasteful little piece of Connecticut suburbia, clouds scudded across the face of a three-quarter moon. Tess thought it was a fine night for a horror movie. She got into her expedition and closed the door. A leaf spun down on the windshield, then dashed away. "I've lost my mind," she said matter-of-factly. "It fell out and died in that culvert, or when I was walking around the store. It's the only explanation for this." She started the engine. Tom the Tom-Tom lit up and said, "Hello, Tess. I see we're taking a trip." "That's right, my friend." Tess leaned forward and programmed 75 Lacemaker Lane into Tom's tidy little mechanical head. 33. She had checked out Ramona's neighborhood on Google Earth, and it looked the same when she got there. So far, so good. Brewster was a small New England town. Lacemaker Lane was on the outskirts, and the houses were far apart. Tess cruised past number 75 at a sedately suburban 20 miles an hour, determining that the lights were on, and only a single car, a late-model Subaru that almost screamed librarian, was in the driveway. There was no sign of a cab over Pete or any other big rig. No old Bondo-patched pickup, either. The street ended in a turnaround. Tess took it, came back, and turned into Norville's driveway without giving herself a chance to hesitate. She killed the lights and the motor, then took a long, deep breath. "Come back safe, Tess," Tom said from his place on the dashboard. "Come back safe, and I'll take you to your next stop."
"I'll do my best."
She grabbed her yellow legal pad, there was now nothing written on it, and got out of her car. She held the pad to the front of her jacket as she walked to Ramona Norville's door. Her moon shadow, perhaps all that was left of the old Tess, walked beside her.
34. Norval's front door had beveled glass strips on either side. They were thick and warped the view, but Tess could make out nice wallpaper and a hallway floored with polished wood. There was an end table with a couple of magazines on it, or maybe they were catalogs. There was a big room at the end of the hall. The sound of a TV came from there. She heard singing, so Ramona probably wasn't watching Saw. In fact, if Tess was right and the song was Climb Every Mountain, Ramona was watching The Sound of Music. Tess rang the doorbell. From inside came a run of chimes that sounded like the opening notes of Dixie, a strange choice for New England, but then, if Tess was right about her, Ramona Norval was a strange woman. Tess heard the clump of big feet and made a half turn, so the light from the beveled glass would catch only a bit of her face. She lowered her blank pad from her chest and made writing motions with one gloved hand. She let her shoulders slump a little. She was a woman taking some kind of survey. It was Sunday evening. She was tired. All she wanted was to discover the name of this woman's favorite toothpaste, or maybe if she had Prince Albert in a can, and then go home. "Don't worry, Ramona. You can open the door. Anybody can see that I'm harmless, the kind of woman who wouldn't say boo to a goose." From the corner of her eye, she glimpsed a distorted fish face swim into view behind the beveled glass. There was a pause that seemed to last a very long time. Then Ramona Norval opened the door. "Yes, can I help you?" Tess turned back. The light from the open door fell on her face, and the shock she saw on Norval's face, the utter drop-jaw shock, told her everything she needed to know.
"You! What are you doing here?"
Tess pulled the lemon squeezer 38 from her right front pocket. On the drive from Stoke Village, she had imagined it getting stuck in there, had imagined it with nightmarish clarity. But it came out smoothly. "Move back from the door. If you try to shut it, I'll shoot you."
"You won't," Norval said.
She didn't move back, but she didn't shut the door either.
"Are you crazy?"
"Get inside." Norval was wearing a big blue housecoat, and when Tess saw the front of it rise precipitously, she raised the gun.
"If you even start to yell, I'll shoot. You better believe me, bitch, because I'm not even close to kidding."
Norville's large bosom deflated. Her lips were drawn back from her teeth and her eyes were shifting from side to side in their sockets. She didn't look like a librarian now, and she didn't look jovial and welcoming. To Tess, she looked like a rat caught outside its hole.
"If you fire that gun, the whole neighborhood will hear."
Tess doubted that, but didn't argue.
"It won't matter to you, because you'll be dead. Get inside. If you behave yourself and answer my questions, you might still be alive tomorrow morning."
Norval backed up, and Tess came in through the open door with the gun held stiffly out in front of her. As soon as she closed the door, she did it with her foot. Norval stopped moving. She was standing by the little table with the catalogs on it.
"No grabbing, no throwing," Tess said,
and saw by the twitch of the other woman's mouth that grabbing and throwing had indeed been in Ramona's mind.
"I can read you like a book. Why else would I be here? Keep backing up all the way down to the living room. I just love the Trapp family when they're really rocking." "You're crazy," Ramona said,
but she began to back up again. She was wearing shoes. Even in her housecoat, she was wearing big, ugly shoes. Men's lace-ups.
"I have no idea what you're doing here, but don't bullshit me, Mommy. Don't you dare. It was all on your face when you opened the door. Every bit of it. You thought I was dead, didn't you?"
"I don't know what you're..."
"It's just us girls, so why not fess up?"
They were in the living room now. There were sentimental paintings on the walls. Clowns, waifs with big eyes,
and lots of shelves and tables cluttered with knickknacks, snow globes, troll babies, Hummel figures, Care Bears, a ceramic candy house a la Hansel and Gretel. Although Norval was a librarian, there were no books in evidence. Facing the TV was a lazy boy with a hassock in front of it. There was a TV tray beside the chair. On it was a bag of cheese doodles, a large bottle of Diet Coke, the remote control, and a TV guide. On top of the television was a framed photograph of Ramona and another woman with their arms around each other and their cheeks pressed together. It looked as if it had been taken at an amusement park or a county fair. In front of the photo was a glass candy dish that gleamed with sparkle points of light beneath the overhead fixture.
How long have you been doing it?
I don't know what you're talking about.
How long have you been pimping for your homicidal rapist of a son?
Norval's eyes flickered, but again she denied it, which presented Tess with a problem. When she had come here, killing Ramona Norval had seemed not just an option, but the most likely outcome. Tess had been almost positive she could do it, and that the boat rope in the left front pocket of her cargo pants would go unused. Now, however, she discovered she couldn't go ahead unless the woman admitted her complicity, because what had been written on her face when she'd seen Tess standing at her door, bruised but otherwise very much alive, wasn't enough. Not quite enough.
When did it start? How old was he? 15? Did he claim he was just fooling around?
That's what a lot of them claim when they first start.
I have no idea what you mean. You come to the library and put on a perfectly acceptable presentation. Lackluster. Obviously, you were only there for the money, but at least it filled the open date on our calendar. And the next thing I know, you're on my doorstep, pointing a gun and making all sorts of wild.
It's no good, Ramona. I saw his picture on the Red Hawk website, ring and all.
He raped me and tried to kill me. He thought he did kill me, and you sent me to him.
Norville's mouth dropped open in a gruesome combination of shock, dismay, and guilt.
That's not true, you stupid cunt. You don't know what you're talking about.
She started forward.
Tess raised the gun.
Nuh-uh. Don't do that. No.
Norval stopped, but Tess didn't think she would stay stopped for long. She was nerving herself up for either fight or flight. And because she had to know Tess would follow her if she tried to run deeper into the house, it would probably be fight. The Trapp family was singing again. Given the situation Tess was in, that she had put herself in, all that happy choral crap was maddening. Keeping the lemon squeezer trained on Norval with her right hand, Tess picked up the remote with her left and muted the TV. She started to put the remote down again, then froze. There were two things on top of the TV, but at first she had only registered the picture of Ramona and her girlfriend. The candy dish had just earned a glance. Now she saw that the sparkles she had assumed were coming from the cut glass sides of the dish weren't coming from the sides at all. They were coming from something inside. Her earrings were in the dish. Her diamond earrings. Norval grabbed the Hansel and Gretel candy house from its shelf and threw it. She threw it hard. Tess ducked and the candy house went an inch over her head, shattering on the wall behind her. She stepped backward, tripped over the hassock, and went sprawling. The gun flew from her hand. They both went for it, Norval dropping to her knees and slamming her shoulder against Tess's arm and shoulder like a football tackle, intent on sacking the quarterback. She grabbed the gun, at first juggling it, then securing her grip. Tess reached inside her jacket and closed her hand around the handle of the butcher knife that was her backup, aware that she was going to be too late. Norval was too big and too maternal.
Yes, that was it. She had protected that rogue son of hers for years, and was intent on protecting him now.
Tess should have shot her in the hall, the moment the door was shut behind her.
But I couldn't, she thought, and even at this moment, knowing it was the truth brought some comfort. She got up on her knees,
hands still inside the jacket, facing Ramona Norville.
"You're a shitty writer and you were a shitty guest speaker," Norville said.
She was smiling, speaking faster and faster. Her voice had a nasal auctioneer's lilt.
"You phoned in your talk the same way you phoned in your stupid books. You were perfect for him and he was going to do someone. I know the signs. I sent you that way, and it worked out right, and I'm glad he fucked you. I don't know what you thought you were going to do coming here, but this is what you get."
She pulled the trigger, and there was nothing but a dry click. Tess had taken lessons when she bought the gun, and the most important had been not to put a bullet in the chamber that would first fall under the hammer, just in case the trigger was pulled by accident. An expression of almost comical surprise came over Norval's face. It made her young again. She looked down at the gun, and when she did, Tess drew the knife from the inside pocket of the jacket, stumbled forward, and jammed it up to the hilt in Norval's belly. The woman made a glassy, "Oh!" sound that tried to be a scream and failed. Tess's pistol dropped, and Ramona staggered back against the wall, looking down at the handle of the knife. One flailing arm struck a rank of Hummel figures. They tumbled from the shelf and shattered on the floor. She made that "Oh!" sound again. The front of the housecoat was still unstained, but blood began to patter from beneath its hem onto Ramona Norville's man shoes. She put her hands on the haft of the knife, tried to tug it free, and made the "Oh!" for the third time. She looked up at Tess, unbelieving. Tess looked back. She was remembering something that had happened on her 10th birthday. Her father had given her a slingshot, and she had gone out looking for things to shoot with it. At some point, 5 or 6 blocks from her house, she had seen a raggedy-eared stray dog rooting in a garbage can. She had put a small rock in her slingshot and fired at it, only meaning to scare the dog away, or so she told herself, but hitting it in the rump instead. The dog had made a miserable "Ike, Ike, Ike!" sound and ran away. But before it did, it gave Tess a look of reproach she had never forgotten. She would have given anything to take that casual shot back, and she had never fired her slingshot at another living thing. She understood that killing was a part of life. She felt no compunction about swatting mosquitoes, put down traps when she saw mouse droppings in the cellar, and had eaten her fair share of Mickey D's quarter pounders. But then she had believed she would never again be able to hurt something that way without feeling remorse or regret. She suffered neither in the living room of the house on Lacemaker Lane, perhaps because, in the end, it had been self-defense. Or perhaps that wasn't it at all. "Ramona," she said, "I'm feeling a certain kinship to Richard Widmark right now. This is what we do to squealers, honey." Norval was standing in a puddle of her own blood, and her housecoat was at last blooming with blood poppies. Her face was pale. Her dark eyes were huge and glittery with shock. Her tongue came out and swiped slowly across her lower lip. "Now you can roll around for a long time thinking it over. How would that be?" Norval began to slide. Her man's shoes made squittering sounds in the blood. She groped for one of the other shelves and pulled it off the wall. A platoon of Care Bears tilted forward and committed suicide. Although she still felt no regret or remorse, Tess found that in spite of her big talk, she had very little inner Tommy Udo. She had no urge to watch or prolong Norville's suffering. She bent and picked up the .38. From the right front pocket of her cargo pants, she removed the item she had taken from the kitchen drawer beside her stove. It was a quilted oven glove. It would silence a single pistol shot quite effectively, as long as the caliber wasn't too big. She had learned this while writing, "The Willow Grove Knitting Society goes on a mystery cruise."
"You don't understand." Norval's voice was a harsh whisper. "You can't do this. It's a mistake. Take me to hospital."
"The mistake was yours." Tess pulled the oven glove over the pistol, which was in her right hand. It was not having your son castrated as soon as you found out what he was.
She put the oven glove against Ramona Norville's temple, turned her head slightly to one side, and pulled the trigger. There was a low, emphatic pluh sound, like a big man clearing his throat. That was all.
35. She hadn't Googled Al Strelke's home address. She had been expecting to get that from Norville. But as she had already reminded herself, things like this never went according to plan. What she had to do now was keep her wits about her and carry the job through to the end. Norville's home office was upstairs, in what had probably been meant as a spare bedroom. There were more Care Bears and Hummels there. There were also half a dozen framed pictures, but none of her sons, her main squeeze, or the late great Roscoe Strelke. These were autographed photos of writers who had spoken to the Brown Baggers. The room reminded Tess of the Stagger Inn's foyer with its band photos.
She didn't ask for an autograph on my photo, Tess thought. Of course not. Why would she want to be reminded of a shitty writer like me? I was basically just a talking head to fill a hole in her schedule. Not to mention meat for her son's meat grinder. How lucky for them that I came along at the right time.
On Norville's desk, below a bulletin board buried in circulars and library correspondence, was a desktop Mac very much like Tess's. The screen was dark, but the glowing light on the CPU told her it was only sleeping. She pushed one of the keys with a gloved fingertip. The screen refreshed, and she was looking at Norville's electronic desktop. No need for those pesky passwords. How nice. Tess clicked the address book icon, scrolled down to the R's, and found Red Hawk Trucking. The address was 7 Transport Plaza, Township Road, College. She scrolled further to the S's and found both her overgrown acquaintance from Friday night and her acquaintance's brother, Lester. Big driver and little driver. They both lived on Township Road, near the company they must have inherited from their father. Alvin at number 23, Lester at number 101.
If there was a third brother, she thought, they'd be the three little truckers. One in a house of straw, one in a house of sticks, one in a house of bricks. Alas, there are only two.
Downstairs again, she plucked her earrings from the glass dish and put them in her coat pocket. She looked at the dead woman sitting against the wall as she did it.
There was no pity in the glance, only the sort of parting acknowledgement anyone may give to a piece of hard work that has now been finished.
There was no need to worry about trace evidence. Tess was confident she had left none, not so much as a single strand of hair. The oven glove, now with a hole blown in it, was back in her pocket. The knife was a common item sold in department stores all over America. For all she knew, or cared, it matched Ramona's own set. So far she was clean, but the hard part might still be ahead. She left the house, got in her car, and drove away. 15 minutes later, she pulled into the lot of a deserted strip mall, long enough to program 23 Township Road, College, into her GPS.
36.
With Tom's guidance, Tess found herself near her destination not long after 9 o'clock. The three-quarter moon was still low in the sky. The wind was blowing harder than ever. Township Road branched off US 47, but at least 7 miles from the Stagger Inn and even farther from Coolidge's downtown. Transport Plaza was at the intersection of the two roads. According to the signage, 3 trucking firms and a moving company were based here. The buildings that housed them had an ugly prefab look. The smallest belonged to Red Hawk Trucking. All were dark on this Sunday night. Beyond them were acres of parking lot, surrounded by cyclone fence and lit with high-intensity arc lights. The depot lot was full of parked cabs and freight haulers. At least one of the cab overs had Red Hawk Trucking on the side, but Tess didn't think it was the one pictured on the website, the one with the proud papa behind the wheel. There was a truck stop adjacent to the depot area. The pumps, over a dozen, were lit by the same high-intensity arcs.
Bright white fluorescence spilled out from the right side of the main building. The left side was dark. There was another building, this one U-shaped, to the rear. A scattering of cars and trucks was parked there. The sign out by the road was a huge digital job, loaded with bright red information. Ritchie's Township Road Truck Stop. You drive 'em, we fill 'em. Regular $2.99 a gallon. Diesel $2.69 a gallon. Newest lottery ticks always available. Restaurant closed Sunday night. Sorry, no showers Sunday night. Store and motel always open. RVs always welcome. And at the bottom, badly spelled but fervent, support our troops. Win in Afghanistan. With truckers coming and going, fueling up both their rigs and themselves, even with its lights off, Tess could tell that, when open, the restaurant was the sort where chicken fried steak, meatloaf, and mom's bread pudding would always be on the menu. The place would probably be a beehive of activity during the week, but on Sunday night, it was a graveyard because there was nothing out here, not even a roadhouse like the Stagger. There was only a single vehicle parked at the pumps, facing out toward the road with a pump nozzle stuck in its gas hatch. It was an old Ford F-150 pickup with Bondo around the headlights. It was impossible to read the color in the harsh lighting, but Tess didn't have to. She had seen that truck close up and knew the color. The cab was empty. You don't seem surprised, Tess, Tom said, as she slowed to a stop on the shoulder of the road and squinted at the store. She could make out a couple of people in there, in spite of the glare from the harsh outside lighting. And she could see that one of them was big. Was he big? Or real big? Betsy Neal had asked. I'm not surprised at all, she said. He lives out here. Where else would he go to gas up? Maybe he's getting ready to take a trip. This late on Sunday night? I don't think so. I think he was at home watching The Sound of Music. I think he drank up all his beer and came down here for more. He decided to top off his tank while he was at it. You could be wrong, though. Hadn't you better pull in behind the store and follow him when he leaves? But Tess didn't want to do that. The front of the truck stop store was all glass. He might look out and see her when she drove in. Even if the bright lighting above the pump islands made it hard for him to see her face, he might recognize the vehicle. There were lots of Ford SUVs on the road, but after Friday night, Al Strelke had to be particularly sensitized to black Ford Expeditions. And there was her license plate. Surely he would have noticed her Connecticut license plate on Friday when he pulled up beside her in the Gone to Weeds parking lot of the deserted store. There was something else, something even more important. She got rolling again, putting Ritchie's Township Road truck stop in the rear view. I don't want to be behind him, she said. I want to be ahead of him. I want to be waiting for him. What if he's married, Tess? Tom asked. What if he's got a wife waiting for him? The idea startled her for a moment. Then she smiled. And not just because the only ring he'd been wearing was the one too big to be a ruby. Guys like him don't have wives, she said. Not ones that stick around anyway. There was only one woman in Al's life, and she's dead.
This ends Disc 7.